Fusco against Jenkins.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Steve Linger. I represent Petitioner Appellant David Fusco. Your Honors, David Fusco's post-conviction and appellate counsel, Jay Height, had an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected his performance. Height had conflicting obligations to his former client, Jacob Sieg, who was also the state's star witness against Fusco at trial. Sieg's trial testimony directly contradicted statements that he'd made to the police immediately after.
I understand your argument about how Height had continuing duties to Sieg. After Sieg was sentenced, why would Height? He couldn't disclose, you know, confidential information. But why would he? I don't know why he would owe anything more to Sieg.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, I think his duty to Sieg would be not to undermine the results of his prior work product.
That's what I don't understand. I mean, Sieg was convicted, right?
Yes.
So he's convicted. So does Height somehow have a responsibility to Sieg to see that he's doesn't violate his parole or something? I mean,
he was convicted of.
It's not that. Of course, Height can't tell the parole authorities or probation or what have you, this guy, Sieg, I represented him, he's a bad guy, don't let him out. It's nothing like that. Sieg's conduct occurs after Height has no longer represents him.
I understand, Your Honor, but Sieg had 2 5-year prison sentences hanging over his head. He was on probation at the time, at all relevant times, and probation was negotiated by Height. If Height had argued in this proceeding that Sieg lied under oath and established that he had, as Height admitted, that would have, as Height put it, certainly led to the probation revocation. And so the question is not whether Height was obligated to protect Sieg from his own conduct in some way. The question is whether...
But that's what it sounds like, right? Because if he knows he's lying, he says he's lying. He doesn't say revoke his probation. It just says, yeah, he's lying. Yeah, I know that.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
It's not that he's asking that he said, you know, I got probation for this guy, but, you know, now I want you to revoke it because he's lying. All he's doing is, in a separate matter, saying a former client currently is lying. That's all.
Well, but he testified that he had the belief that if he had done that, the probation would have been revoked, and he would have been undoing his own prior work product. And also,
I don't understand how your client's sentence is your work product that you're proud of. I don't understand that.
I'm not sure if he was proud of it, Your Honor, but I...
What's the point? I don't understand.
What's the point?
I think that there are 2 points. Number one, the subject matter of the impeachment. In order to effectively impeach Sieg, he would have had to reveal the probation status. So the impeachment evidence would have been the result
probation
of the prior...
status is not... client confidence.
That's right.
I share Judge Posner's puzzlement. Much of your argument seems to rest on the proposition that if an attorney has ever represented someone, for the rest of the attorney's life, he owes some kind of fiduciary duty to that person to do him good. But I'd always thought the attorney's duty was simply to refrain from revealing client confidences.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's part of the duty. That's correct, but the attorney can't. A conflict may arise if the attorney represents, if a subsequent representation by the attorney is substantially related to his prior representation. And in this, I'm not claiming that
substantially related in some way other than the fact that the work might entail something protected by the attorney-client privilege.
Yes, Your Honor. I think in this case,
I don't understand the basis of it. Is there some ethical rule in Wisconsin? You know, Wisconsin is progressive in many ways. For all I know, the La Follettes got in place some ethical rule unknown in the rest of the world. Is there something we need to be aware of?
Well, there's no ethical rule in Wisconsin that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but the constitutional principle...
There's a lot of ethical rules in Wisconsin.
I mean...
there are no ethical rules in Illinois, is what you meant to say.
No ethics in Illinois.
No pertinent ethical rule, I should say. But what we're interested in here is the governing the principle from the Supreme Court case law. And just to be clear, Your Honors, I'm not arguing that an attorney has a perpetual duty of loyalty and that he could never take any action that is adverse to the interests of a former client. For example, he could impeach a former client about matters that have nothing to do with his prior representation, even if it exposed him to future punishments. But in this case, the impeachment evidence related directly to his prior representation of Sieg, and he couldn't have successfully impeached Sieg without undoing the results of the prior representation.
I was going to just ask you about something else here. It didn't look like this fellow was all that important in this case to begin with. It looked like the main witness was the guy who robbed the one joint one day, and then your guy allegedly robbed the place the next day, and it was his testimony that put your guy in the soup here, not really this little peripheral.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree because there are only three other witnesses that implicated Hosko in this crime, and as Your Honor noted, one of them was...
Well, of course, what's completely obvious is that Hosko was involved in both crimes because it doesn't matter whether you're the getaway driver or the person who goes in and sticks up the bank. So the jury, you know, unaccountably exercising lenity, let him off of the one where he was the getaway driver. But that... No.
Actually, Your Honor, the fact that the jury acquitted him of the first crime suggests to me that it didn't credit the testimony of Madison King.
Well, I see just the opposite. They wouldn't have convicted him the second. If they wouldn't believe anything this guy said, he would never have been convicted.
Madison?
Yeah.
Well,
the jury didn't believe anything Madison said, your man would have been convicted. Acquitted.
Would not have been convicted?
Would have been acquitted.
Would have been acquitted. Well, but in the second trial, the one he was convicted of, we have Sieg's testimony. Now, Sieg was the only witness that positively identified him from the videotape. Okay, without Sieg's testimony, that videotape would have had minimal...
But you're not saying Hosko, you're not saying he was not the getaway driver.
Pardon me?
Your theory of this, of the one he was convicted on, what he was just the getaway driver there, too.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Okay, but if he's the getaway driver in both cases, he's guilty.
But he was acquitted in the first case.
Yes, I know. The juries do things like that. But there's no... They obviously thought that it was worse to go in than to be the getaway driver. They thought that. They were wrong. They didn't understand the law. So he gets a break. But there's no... Since there's no doubt about the person's guilt, I see where the prejudice is.
Well, I mean, Your Honors, I still say the Sieg's testimony...
You can't argue that since we know the jury was irrational, somehow he had a shot at being acquitted of the second crime also. That's not a good argument.
I have
to show the reasonable jury would have, you know, might very well have decided to acquit him if it hadn't been for Height's involvement. It seems very implausible.
Well, I don't mean to beat a dead horse here, but to me, I think that his acquittal in the first case and his conviction in the second case is consistent with the idea that the jury credited Sieg's testimony over the other witnesses. But
you've already admitted he's guilty in the second case because he was the getaway driver. I don't know what's left.
I admitted that, I didn't mean to admit that.
Of course you did. There's no doubt about that, is there? There's some doubt whether he actually went into the bank the second time, even though that was the deal.
You're talking about the convenience store.
There isn't any doubt that if he didn't go into the bank, he was driving his co-defendant.
You're talking convenience store.
Convenience store, right. Where it was, right?
I just want to make sure.
There's no doubt about that.
Well, I don't understand. Your Honor, I'm sorry. I don't understand why there's no doubt about... I mean, what testimony placed him as the getaway driver in the second crime other than Mattis's testimony?
What, you don't think he would participate in the second crime at all?
No.
I thought you admitted that he was...
No, I hadn't. If I admitted that, I misspoke, Your Honor. I did not admit that in my briefs. My point...
I've got one more problem for you in still a different direction, which is I don't understand how we're in federal court at all. The lawyer you say was ineffective in failing to raise arguments about another lawyer's supposed ineffectiveness in a post-conviction proceeding. And 28 U.S.C. 2254I says that a federal writ of habeas corpus cannot be based on the ineffective performance of post-conviction counsel, period. So let's assume that post-conviction counsel was ineffective. Given 2254I, how could there be a federal writ?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that statute refers to a state post-conviction proceeding, a collateral proceeding. And because of a quirk of Wisconsin procedure, what I'm calling a post-conviction proceeding here is really a part of the direct appeal. This court has recognized that, so have the Wisconsin federal courts. The second post-conviction proceeding, that proceeding is collateral.
That's 974-06.
That is the equivalent to a state habeas petition. The first proceeding, the one where we're alleging the height was his performance was inadequate, was brought under 809.30, which is an integral part of the direct appeal process. It's a prerequisite to further appeal. And the Supreme Court has held that in direct appeals, a defendant has a Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel.
So don't we need to separate the post-conviction part from the direct appeal part?
No. I mean, are you talking about the second post-conviction proceeding?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, I'm not going to pursue it because the state has not raised it and has forfeited whatever benefit there is. So, thanks very much.
Well, let me just ask Judge Easterbrook a question. Do you have any complaint about the separate post-conviction proceeding?
The second one?
Yes.
Well, it's not part of this.
So that's not involved. It's
the first one.
Just the first one.
Right.
Which was part of the direct appeal.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Winger. Ms. Lloyd.
May it please the Court, I'm Kate Lloyd, representing the respondent in this habeas matter in which the state of Wisconsin is clearly the real party at interest. The state simply asked this court to affirm the order of the district court adopting the report and recommendation of the magistrate judge denying Mr. Husko habeas relief. As the R&R states, Mr. Husko has failed to show that the Court of Appeals decision finding that Mr. Height was not under an actual conflict of interest is not a decision that is an unreasonable application of Supreme Court law. So unless there are any questions... Thank you.
Sound like it. Well, Mr. Winger, there isn't very much for you to reply to. You have any last-minute thoughts? Right. Well, we appreciate your willingness, Mr. Winger, and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case, and we appreciate the assistance to both your client and the court. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement.